stop it. Let's do something. And let's fix the biggest crisis in the history of this country.
This is Mark Steiner. Welcome, everybody, to our special two-hour broadcast to honor and reflect on the 10th anniversary of Katrina. Right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Katrina was the deadliest hurricane in American history. 1,465 people were killed. Dozens are still missing. 500 bodies are still unidentified. And the money has dried up to even complete that work. Almost all of those killed were poor, and most of those were African Americans, as are most of the 100,000 people who could not return to New Orleans because their homes and neighborhoods were never rebuilt, or because the cost of housing is now too high for them to survive in New Orleans. Today we look back to the time when Katrina hit, when the levees broke that brought the floodwaters in, to examine what has happened in the intervening years and what New Orleans is like right now. For the next 2 hours, we talk with the people of New Orleans who lived through it, who are fighting to reclaim their heritage, their communities, and their city. Over the next 2 hours, you will hear and take part in our conversations with Tracy Washington, who's president of the Louisiana Justice Institute, James Perry, a New Orleanian, former director of the Greater New Orleans for Housing Action Center, Jordan Flaherty, a New Orleans-based journalist and filmmaker, also wrote the book Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Genesis 6, a new short film he's made called New Orleans, Recovery or Removal. Christina K. Robinson, writer, artist, and New Orleans native, who wrote a piece for The Nation, as did Jordan Flaherty. Karen Gadbois, founder and reporter for The Lens, New Orleans' first investigative news nonprofit. Adam Carlin, a freelance journalist and travel writer who lives in New Orleans. Ellis Marcellus III, photographer, writer, and poet. Tara Conley, who's a social media manager at Race Forward, and producer of the short film Kellen and Katrina, which is the story of Kellen and the full-length Brackish, a visual ethnography of Hurricane Katrina, and Kellen himself, who's a musician and subject of the film Kellen and Katrina. So we hope you enjoy this special documentary program on Katrina 10 years later. We're about to have a conversation here on this 10th anniversary of Katrina with Tracy Washington, who is president of the Louisiana Justice Institute. And Tracy Washington, welcome back to the program. Good to have you with us once again.
It's great being back.
So it's been 5 years since we last talked on the fifth anniversary of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And one statistic I read, thinking about this, was what's happening in your city, your city that you grew up in, that you live in, that is your home, is you lost 100,000 people from 480,000 to 380,000, most of those being African-Americans from New Orleans who were poor, who left, never came back.
Yes.
Tell me about what the social political situation is now around all of that.
You know, it's difficult, I suspect, for folks to imagine what it would be like to lose basically, a fourth of your city, or just such a, that's not a fourth of the city, but just that big a demographic, right?
Yeah, yes.
Mostly poor people, but not all poor. A lot of middle-class African-Americans. African-Americans who have been fired because, you know, we fired 7,500 Orleans Parish school board employees, mostly teachers and paraprofessionals, just in one shot. So a lot of those folks who were away had to stay away because they had no jobs. Hmm. A lot of city employees. So my point is, in a very real sense, a very stable part of our community. On top of that, the bottom line is people come to New Orleans and visit New Orleans for its culture. And when you lose that significant portion of your city, you're bound to lose a significant part of your culture. We've tried to replace it, but it's watered down, really, to me. And so when folks ask me, what's New Orleans like, it is a watered-down version to me of what it used to be. And while folks will say, yeah, but the education is better, the housing is better, the economic development is better, I say to them, you are absolutely correct. The white folk who were here got richer. And the white folk who come have seen riches they never could have seen other places. Who would have ever thought that you could be a 21-year-old and come here and make $500,000 selling that dog, that burger, that whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But those are not the opportunities that were here for the black folk who remained. And so the economic disparities and the wealth gap has widened. Before Hurricane Katrina, African-Americans and whites made twice as much as the average African-American. Now it's three times as much.
Really?
Yeah. And that wealth gap has widened just like that. And while more kids, quote-unquote, are graduating high school, this is true. Unfortunately, what we also have is a situation where far less black kids statistically are making it from ninth grade to 12th grade, right? So when they give you the stat of, look at the number of people who are graduating, watch that number. The trick is that they count from the beginning of 12th grade to the end of 12th grade. I count from 8th grade to 12th grade. And I'm saying, well, wait a minute. These children not graduating. They say, yes, they are. If we get them to 12th grade, they graduate. Wait. Can we count the ones that fall off along the way? So I make light of it because I'd have to lose my mind if I didn't. My expression right now is everything on the avenue looks clean and pretty. Go three blocks in and tell me what you see.
So, you know, one of the what you're describing here, and I think this is really important to get to the bottom of. I mean, I think that when you say that the culture's watered down and things have changed, and you look at where white New Orleanians, were making twice as much as black folks now, three times as much. I mean, what's the dynamic here? I mean, what happened? How did that happen?
You disrupted this crazy, and maybe some people would say warped equilibrium of African American and white and Hispanic power in the city. You know, you lose 100,000 people, you lose voting power. You lose the ability to get up and march when people start getting out of line. You just march on City Hall, won't you? People to march with City Hall says, oh, we got this now. You know, and that's real. You know, we had a city where we had an African-American mayor. We had a city council that was majority African-American, but, you know, the council at large positions were always one black, one white. That was the unspoken rule. That was the equilibrium. And post-Hurricane Katrina, you know, folks said we don't have to play by those rules anymore. And we knew when it happened. It was in a Dallas meeting right after Hurricane Katrina. It's been documented. You have to excuse my expression, but we call them the Confederate gentry here in New Orleans.
That's polite.
Right. They got together. It's documented. We even know who it was, but we got the names, right? They don't have a problem admitting to it. In a hotel in Dallas, 57, two African-American, whole white room, and they said, this is how we're going to remake the city. They planned on how to remake the city. They said what percentage of African-American they wanted the city to be.
Are you saying this is all documented?
He reported out. Black mayor, he said, I can't believe y'all were trying to do this. And they're like, this is what we're going to do. And that's exactly what they did do. I mean, I look at people like, I can't believe this happened. I said, well, they told you what they were going to do. We just didn't have the power to do anything about it.
Well, you have been an activist for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And a teacher. And been in the midst of all this, fighting around housing rights and education rights and the rights of poor people in New Orleans. And I mean, this has been your life. You've been doing this for a long, long time. So, I mean, but what does that do to you? What does that say to you about where New Orleans is going? What happens to the New Orleans that was the heart of black culture, one of the hearts of black culture and American culture?
You know, people say to me, I can't believe you stay. Why are you still there fighting? Well, I know if it weren't for, you know, NAACP, Legal Defense Fund, and Judy Brown Dianis and Penda Hare with the Advancement Project, and Bill Quigley with Loyola and Southern Poverty Law Center, it'd be a whole lot worse. You know, it would be a whole lot worse. Everything that was planned hasn't happened. And now that folks are returning, I'm seeing a resurgence, really, of advocacy. I'm seeing some pushback. Some more, even more so now. You know, we've suffered some losses, absolutely. But folks didn't give up. They were beat up, but they didn't give up. And I'm really proud of the fact that folks haven't given up. I don't say all is lost. We've taken our licks, but I don't think all is lost, right? So,
and so I stay because I say, well, somebody's got to fight. You know, somebody's got to fight.
So when you say fight, when you look at the situation with the schools and with housing and the kind of how the whole equilibrium of the city has changed and moved towards the new all these new people moving in who are mostly white. I mean, what is that? When you say you stay to fight, what do you see yourself fighting for? What does this 10th anniversary of Katrina say to you about what has to happen now?
I guess the best thing that has happened so far, because I was checking out for the 10th anniversary. Y'all caught me at a good time because I wasn't even doing interviews. I was so disgusted because, you know, everybody wanted to put on the pretty show. Oh, come to New Orleans for this 10th anniversary, see all the pretty. Fortunately, we've had reporters from outside who get it, who actually look at the mayor and say, well, wait a minute, you're telling us education is great, but you've got more people in jail per capita than you used to have.
Wait a minute, you've got more say that money. Again?
Wait, something is not working here. And
they're forcing a lot of folks to
truth. And with that truth-telling, right, even the normal New Orleanian, the person who hasn't been fighting, has said, well, you know, I got to get involved in this. I do understand what I've lost, and I do want it back. You know, I want those music teachers back because I don't like what they're playing in the street right now. You know, I want those teachers back because, you know, I want my child educated by those traditional teachers. And so I'm starting to hear that. And it's almost like it's people rebelling against the narrative that the mayor and a lot of folks were trying to give about New Orleans. It's sort of crazy. It's hard to explain, but I've been hearing it for the past week just this week and over the past week, and they're like, no, we're not going down like this. You know, and I said, great. This is wonderful. If you want your culture back, this is how we have to keep fighting. If you want your kids really educated, even those special needs kids, this is how we got to keep fighting. And so I'm not Pollyannish. It's still a lot of work. But, we still going to do it.
You know, I'm thinking about this in a historical context, too. I was thinking about, you know, just a month ago, July 30th, barely a month before the Katrina anniversary, it was the anniversary of when the black folks who got political power after the Civil War were attacked and hundreds of people were killed in the New Orleans riots of July 30th when the white folks attacked and killed the newly enfranchised people. And so, I mean, the struggle in New Orleans is a long one.
It is.
Right?
It really is. You know, you think about the Haitians who came here. You think about maybe that's embedded in our lifeblood, that this is a city where we're always going to be struggling. And, Lola's Eli said that yesterday, and I thought to myself, I don't mean to cuss, but after we finished the interview, I said, well, damn, Lola. Don't depress me.
But I we're talking to you here from Baltimore, where there's a huge spike in murders and other things happening in the city for lots of complex reasons. But when you just said a moment ago, before you go to explore this.
And
moment,
can I just stop you for a second
yeah,
and
yes.
just say, you know, when I do get down, I think, yeah, but then there's Baltimore. I'm sorry. Everybody in Baltimore quit.
That's okay. But, I mean, what is going on when you said there's a spike in arrests in the black community and people going to jail and bigger incarceration rates with 100,000 less people?
You know, it is. I don't
I don't know that I really get it, but I will share with you something I heard yesterday. One of the co-founders of the Hot 8 Brass Band was on stage at this conference, and he was just sort of, I think some people were thinking he was just rambling, but he was talking about the fact that he's 39 years old, he's buried four members of his band post-Katrina. You know, he's like, you know, these brothers just feel hopeless. You know, you get trained, you pay to train to go get a job, and then there's no job. And he was just almost like, you know, melancholy. And that was really one of the first times that I'd heard that perspective from someone who wasn't in their 20s, like a person who survived his 20s and now is still feeling like an elder statesman, explaining to a group of older folk, I survived this, but let me tell you how folks are feeling. And they don't want to bang up people, but this is what they're going to do if there's nothing else to do, if there's no other way to eke out a living. And it just, hearing it from him, I think, made that audience, it affected me as a 51-year-old differently than when I hear it from a 22-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to explain why it was so different for me. Maybe it was because it was from a person who was kind of like, I survived this. I'm on the other side, but let me tell you what's on that other side. I just survived it. I just got out of it. I don't think that any people in our country should be in that state. And so I suspect the brothers in Baltimore have that same perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a horrible thing that we've done to them, isn't it?
Absolutely is. No, it absolutely is. And I just, you know, I think about the future of New Orleans, and I think about the 100,000 people who are still part of the diaspora who have not come home to New Orleans.
Yeah, well, you know, and our mayor, bless his heart, the last two weeks, went to Atlanta and to Houston to say, we want you back. Somebody got up in one of those audiences and said, you want us back now, 10 years later, after you've spent the $171 billion? When rents are 50% higher, when there's still no hospital or no real jobs, there's a hospital but no real jobs in New Orleans, what are we coming back to? I said, I got a job in Houston when y'all didn't want to employ me. I put my kids through school already. What do you have for me? And the mayor couldn't answer. Well, we really want you back. He said, are you going to give me some of that $171 billion you spent? I mean, the mayor was embarrassed, and he should have been. Can you imagine? I don't even know why he did that. I'm going to Atlanta and to Houston to tell the people we're ready for him. Isn't it crazy?
So, before you go off to teach a class, where do you see the future going?
For a while, it's going to stay in this trend. I'm going to be honest with you. Until we really get the equilibrium, be it an equilibrium at, you know, 55% African-American, 59%, 60%, 65%, until we get comfortable. And the city still isn't comfortable yet. It's not comfortable because even though, you know, we're at this number, and white folk are saying, oh, shoot, did we decrease too much? Because maybe we have lost a little bit of culture, and that's where we make our money. Should we get a few more? How many more should we get? The mayor went to get some, but do we want all the, which ones do we want? You know, they don't know yet, right? They don't know yet. And until we get to that happy number, you know, it's still going to be rocky. It's just going to be rocky.
Well, Tracy Washington, I just want to say that, first of all, I appreciate you taking the time with us today. I know you had a very busy day. You're off to teach a class. But to me, part of what you say is part of the heart and soul of New Orleans, and to have your voice in this program means a great deal to me. And I just want to thank you for taking the time. I would like to stay in touch and do more of these conversations, because I think New Orleans and Baltimore need to stay closer in touch.
Look, I love Baltimore, and we should. And I appreciate you giving me a call.
Tracy Washington, president of the Louisiana Justice Institute. Thank you so much, Tracy.
Thank you.
We're about to take a very brief break, but don't go away. There's more in our Katrina 10th anniversary special. Stay with us.
I said, oh, 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 ah, ah, my oop, oop, a doo, my oop, oop, a doo, yeah. I said, it don't matter.
We won't help. We won't help. We won't help.
Don't tell me 40,000 people are coming here. They're not here. It's too doggone late. Now get off the haters and let's do something.
CLR Nation.
1, 2, 3. Four.
This is for the streets. The streets everywhere. The streets affected by the storm called America. I'm doing this for y'all and for me, for the creator.
God said these streets, $1 per a human being. Feel like Katrina clap. See that Katrina clap. Listen, homie.
This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Right here on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we're going back now to our special production, Katrina, the 10th anniversary. We're now about to talk to James Perry. He's a lifelong New Orlean, former director of the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Action Center, and continues to be active in the life of New Orleans. And James Perry, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, James, you grew up in New Orleans, right?
Yeah, sure did. Sure did. I call it home.
So I'm going to go back 10 years. Where were you on the day Katrina hit?
That day, I was kind of making my rounds, checking on family, and I got a call from my mom, who told me that she and my dad were preparing to evacuate. And I was kind of shocked because my dad never evacuated. You know, we rode out every storm, and we'd just get our supplies and ride it out, and so I was pretty surprised to hear that, and so it made me rethink my own plans, and so I started to get things together and get the processes going so that I could evacuate as well.
Were you in law school then? This is before.
I was.
You were in law school.
In law school. I was. I think that was in my. I guess I just finished my first year of law school. Started my second year. Yeah.
So when all this happened, did you leave the state, or did you just go off a little further north?
Yeah, so what happens is that so first of all, on that day, like I said, my pop says, let's go, and but we have a terribly difficult time convincing my grandparents to leave. So we don't actually get in the car to leave until the very last possible moment that you can leave. And as we're leaving, they're closing down the highways. And so we end up having to drive south towards the storm in order to get out of the out of town. And so and actually some of the interstates are shut down. And so we take these little rinky-dink highways to get out. And we drive through Mississippi and evacuate to Birmingham, Alabama. My father's from Birmingham. And so we go to a family member's house in Birmingham, and we just presume that we would be there for, overnight or so. And we wake up the next morning, and at first it seemed that everything was fine. And so we were, thinking we'd head back. But, of course, by midday, the city had flooded, and it was pretty clear that there was no heading back anytime soon. And so there were probably about 20 of us. And so we ended up, 20 of us, kind of camped out in a two-bedroom house. And so most of my family stayed there. But I headed back to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and opened my office, which was the Fair Housing Center. And we started doing work immediately, working on housing issues, probably within about 3 or 4 days of the storm.
So I wonder, in the very beginnings, in the first few weeks after Katrina hit and all folks left the city, and then things began to happen. Of course, President Bush responded very slowly, as if there was no crisis at all. And we all remember that when that happened. And I wonder when it began to hit you that something was amiss here in terms of what was happening to the population of New Orleans, especially the black folks in New Orleans. What was happening? That something weird politically and economically was afoot. When did it first hit you that something was wrong?
You know, it hit me, I think, pretty quickly, and I think the reason is that in the group of people who evacuated, it was my parents who were homeowners, my grandparents who were homeowners, my aunt who was a homeowner, myself who was a homeowner, and then a family friend who was a homeowner. And so we're all, and there were a few other people, but I guess my point in naming all the homeowners is that all of us were looking in, on television, and then we were able to see not necessarily our own homes, but certainly our neighborhoods completely submerged, and we knew that we had lost everything. And we knew almost immediately that there was, that it was gone. That there was nothing left for us, and there were no answers, and certainly the mayor had no answers, and certainly the governor had no answers, my girlfriend at the time was with me, and she couldn't reach her father, and days became weeks, became months, and she still couldn't reach her father. And it became very, very clear that no one knew what was going on, and no one had any idea what to do.
So I just, both on a human and kind of social, analytical level and political level, what do you think happened there? I mean, we all know what happened looking at it. I mean, obviously. But I mean, what do you think the dynamic was that allowed literally for the destruction of the black communities in places like the Ninth Ward and Moore in New Orleans? What was the dynamic, do you think?
Well, Katrina actually wasn't the perfect storm, but I do think that Mayor Nagin, President Bush, and Governor Blanco together did create the perfect political storm. Mayor Nagin, I think, would have been a fine mayor for the city of New Orleans were he a mayor in normal times. But, we needed a mayor ready to govern in a time of disaster and a time of war. And he wasn't up for the task, frankly. And then, of course, he had a terrible relationship with Governor Blanco. And Governor Blanco, of course, had a terrible relationship with Governor Bush. And so three people who disliked one another and who all were bad at this particular part of their jobs. I mean, they all excelled at certain other parts of their jobs, but this particular part, they were terrible at it. And so I think that the combination of three people who just weren't prepared to handle disaster is what made it happen. Because the thing that happens over and over again when I talk to people outside of New Orleans about Katrina is that they presume that Katrina hit the city of New Orleans, but the fact is that it didn't. The eye of the storm actually hit Mississippi. I guess I'd also note that there is a greater lesson here that has, in many ways, nothing to do with those three politicians, but it does have, I think, something to do with American policy writ large, and that's our decisions about American infrastructure. Katrina missing the city of New Orleans, but the city still flooding, has everything to do with decisions over decades not to to fund the process of maintaining the federal levees that surround the city of New Orleans. And so after decades of neglect, they failed, not when a storm hits the levees, but actually when a storm misses them. And so I do think that there are challenges like this that exist all across the nation, where federal infrastructure is ripe for failure. And if we don't invest in it, there are lots of other Katrinas that can easily happen unless we decide to invest in our own infrastructure.
So we've talked to some other folks who really thought in many ways that there were decisions made way beyond almost the political structure itself, the elected structure, to build New Orleans in a certain way, and not to do something that would appeal to bring back the diaspora, the 100,000 people who left and never returned. I mean, what's your thought on that?
Yeah, I think it's a very complex question. I don't think I have friends who believe that folks conspired to keep African Americans from returning to the city of New Orleans. And while there certainly are people who preferred that African Americans not return, I don't think that there was some group of political evildoers who huddled and were able to do so in this very purposeful way. But I do think that a series of foolish blunders did have that effect of keeping people from returning. Over and over again, it became the mistakes in the rebuilding process just made it easier for people to stay where they were rather than to return to the city of New Orleans. If you already had your, so let's back up for a second and just consider that the city of New Orleans had terrible failing schools before Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
If you evacuated and your kids ended up in a really strong, high-performing school, and you lost your home and lost everything, and you had a bad job before the storm, and you got a great job in some other community, and every time that you tried to return to the city of New Orleans, you ended up in the same poor job opportunity, and your kids were going to go back to the same poor performing school or a school that was even worse performing, and you were going to end up in the same neighborhood where the crime rate was high. The city wasn't offering a lot of opportunity for people who were struggling before the storm. And so, I know a lot of people who made a purposeful decision not to return. So I don't think that it all lays on the heads of the political elite. And certainly there are a lot of bad decisions that they made. But it's hard to make a way in New Orleans, and it was even harder after the storm.
But as a man who for all those years was the kind of heart and soul of the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Action Center, you fought a number of cases like against the Road Home Program to make sure money came in. I mean, there was a battle to ensure that the money for housing and other things actually went to the community itself.
Well, there's no doubt about that, but I guess that speaks to the very point that I'm making. It's that if you applied to this program, it's a $12 billion with a B dollar program to help people rebuild their homes, and you're hearing about all these people getting tons and tons of money to rebuild their homes, and you apply, your home gets wiped out, you apply for money, and you get $25,000, but you know folks who got $100,000 and $200,000 and everyone else got all this cash, but you got almost nothing. Well, why come back? And sure, James Perry is down there fighting his butt off to get you some more money.
Right.
And after 3 or 4 years, he finally settles a lawsuit that gets you some money. But by the time that's all done, it's 4 or 5 years later. Your kid is made it through high school and, on and on and on. You've made a new life for yourself. It makes it hard to come back.
So what do you think that portends for the future of the city? I mean, it's the city you love, grew up in. You say, despite your wife being one place, you're teaching, now you keep going back because it's your town, you believe in it. So where do you think it's going?
Well, that's the question that I think many New Orleanians are struggling with this entire week, this 10-year anniversary. And, I think that it feels very differently from the way that the number, very differently from the numbers, the story that the numbers tell. So, for instance, if you're in the city, and in many ways the city feels a lot like it felt 10 years ago. You know, it's when you're downtown, it's hustling and bustling. The French Quarter is happening, and you know, you can still have a really great time in the city. People are doing business in the city, and I think probably the city hasn't been this ripe for business since the 70s, you know, and there's a level of optimism when it comes to business that the city hasn't seen, at least since the 70s. But on the other hand, there are some statistics that are just absolutely scary and frustrating. So, for instance, 52% of African-American men in New Orleans are unemployed.
Wow.
When you visit the Lower Ninth Ward, it's you know, very clear when you look, but you know, the data shows that less than 7% of homes have been rebuilt in the Lower Ninth Ward. The murder rate right now is higher than it was before Hurricane Katrina, which is frustrating because we had gotten to a point that the murder rate was at an all-time low. And I can kind of keep going on and keep ticking off statistics, but I guess the point is that we've gotten to a point where it's this tale of two cities, where neighborhoods that were performing well before the storm are doing even better, but neighborhoods that were suffering before the storm are doing far, far worse. And so I think my fear is that if, when we check back in 10 years, the pockets that are doing well will probably continue to do well. And I don't know if they'll be doing better, but they'll continue to do well. But for a community like the Lower Ninth Ward, I'm pretty afraid. I don't know that there's going to be another chance for the Lower Ninth Ward to come back. It's going to take hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of investment for the Lower Ninth Ward to return. And I think we had one shot at that kind of federal investment, and it came immediately after the storm, and that money wasn't spent in an equitable way. It wasn't spent in a way that ensured that the Lower Ninth Ward would be rebuilt. And so I don't know, and it certainly hasn't been rebuilt yet. And I'm not optimistic that we'll see it rebuilt in 10 years.
But just to wind this up a little bit, James, but you're a man who's decided to stand and fight.
Well, and let me be somewhat clear. You know, my wife and I kind of split our time a bit. You know, we call New Orleans home, but we also call North Carolina home, and we call New York home. And, you know, so I'm not there as much as I would like anymore. And, you know, so there are a lot of other advocates who are much more full-time than I am. And, you know, and so, you know, a lot of my energy now goes to supporting them as much as possible.
Well, James Perry, I've been a long admirer of your work and what you've done in New Orleans and the way you fought. And I thought probably had some of the best campaign commercials ever in the history of the United States during your run for mayor. And I want to thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate your time.
Cause Uptown trying to shake.
Yo, get back now. Yo, get back now. Yo, get back now. Get back now. Shake for the money. Bounce to the floor. Toot it up. Hot, girl, let's go. Shake for the money. Bounce to the floor. Toot it up. Hot, girl, let's go. Yo, get back now. Yo, get back now. Yo, get back now. Yo, get back now.
We're about to talk to Jordan Flaherty, who is a New Orleans-based journalist and producer, filmmaker, works the Laura Flanders Show, author of Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to Jenna 6. And in this most recent issue of The Nation magazine, he wrote the piece Resistance in the Key of Life, New Movements Bloom in a City with a Long History of Defiance. And Jordan, good to have you here on The Mark Steiner Show. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. And thank you for all the coverage you do on this show.
Thank you. Appreciate that. So I was really fascinated by your piece because, as we talked earlier to another guest, that the whole that resistance is part of the name of the black community of Louisiana, New Orleans. I mean, it's built, as a Cuban friend of mine said to me when in Santiago a few months ago, he said to be African in the Western Hemisphere is resistance. That's what it means. And I think that's apt for New Orleans.
Absolutely.
So tell me about your sense of that, and from your you've been living there, and what that sense of resistance has come to mean for you since Katrina.
Well, I think that people around the world have heard of aspects of New Orleans culture, whether it's the Mardi Gras parades or jazz funerals or brass bands parading down the street, what we call second lines. But I think what people have not realized is that this culture has been maintained really as an act of defiance against a dominant white supremacist culture of the rest of the state and rest of the country. The people are maintaining this kind of African Caribbean culture as a form of resistance. But more directly, if you look at much of the history of protests in this city, many of the key organizers have been cultural workers. These organizations called Social Aid and Pleasure Clubs, and I think that name is so key, Social Aid and Pleasure Club, have been responsible for maintaining much of the city's culture, but have also been really involved in supporting community, uplifting community, whether it's actually being part of protests or just raising money to get books for kids. They've been a key part of the culture. The Mardi Gras Indians, also part of the culture, they go out and parade. They, by principle, never ask for permits from the police, never ask for permission, and have really kind of bent the official city policy towards where the city has had to recognize them just through their kind of force of will. And, you know, these second lines, this parading that people see in New Orleans, in many ways, it's this direct action of sort of claiming the civil right to be in the street and claim the street.
One of the things you say in this piece, I find it very interesting. You said that, just read this to you. In the same way that many activists in the Black Lives Matter and Occupy movement say their political awakening grew out of the frustration they felt with the lack of change in the Obama era, many activists here in New Orleans say that the period of planning and rebuilding after Katrina showed them they needed to fight in this city, or they would be taken away from them. So you're seeing there's been this growth because of that, this outgrowth of resistance movements of younger people and other people since Katrina, very specific to that.
Absolutely. When I talk to people in the streets here and communities, people talk about this period really showing them that they had to fight to be in the city, and not just fight because rents are going up and salaries are not going up, but really fight because there was this planning process that people were cut out of. You had the entire school system was reshaped without the input of students or parents or teachers. In fact, the entire staff of the school system was fired, something that disproportionately affected women, disproportionately affected African Americans. You had the public housing was basically closed down overnight, and residents were not allowed to return back, and then this process was started up to have it demolished. So people really found they had to fight for their homes, fight for their jobs, fight for their schools, fight for their hospital, fight for their community to be able to come back. You know, they couldn't just live their life as normal. Every aspect of daily life became a struggle.
So talk about some of these groups that exploded. I was really fascinated with reading the piece you wrote for The Nation. Organizations like that, let me start with two of them here, El Congreso. And another group you define. I'm only taking these two groups first because the connection here, and Stand with Dignity. Both very different, Latino and Black workers, but talk a bit about these movements, what started them and how they kind of connected.
Yeah, you know, I think they are different organizations. One thing that's exciting about the Congress of Day Laborers is at their weekly meetings, they have 400 members coming out,
wow.
Which I think is really
that's amazing.
Exceptional. And they, a couple times in the last year and a half, have done direct actions against what they've seen as unjust enforcement by immigration authorities. And undocumented people have gone out and risked arrest by the dozens against these. So it's an active community, and they've won real victories on changing city policies on everything from fighting people who have been trying to do wage theft against these communities. They've actually changed the policies at the city jail, where the city jail became the first in the South to not cooperate with immigration holds with immigration department. So they've won real victories. Stand for Dignity, the organization of black workers, has also won real victories on getting these workers jobs in Reconstruction. You know, you had the public housing torn down, and these former residents who are trying to get by can't even get jobs in the tearing down and rebuilding that's happening in their neighborhood. So this was another thing that that Stand for Dignity fought for. They also fought for a change in allowing people who have criminal convictions to still be able to live in public housing, which was actually a national policy change
right. That
came out of a struggle here in New Orleans, and it's still being fought over. But that that change in policy came out of New Orleans. Those two organizations actually started and are affiliated through an organization called the New Orleans Workers Center for Racial Justice, that formed post-Katrina. And one of the keys of their analysis, as stated by their director, Saket Soni, is you had black workers locked out and Latino workers locked in. So black workers were locked out of the jobs in Reconstruction, while Latino workers were locked into wage theft, unsafe working conditions, low pay, hazardous conditions. And so both of these communities were both exploited and pitted against each other. So this founding of these organizations that would collaborate together was on the specific idea that they were facing a same enemy that was oppressing them in different ways and was, in fact, pitting them against each other, and that they would be stronger together. And since then, you've had more efforts at building those ties, including after Arizona passed their law against, with stricter enforcement against recent immigrants. They sent a delegation of black workers to Arizona that came back and talked about the racial profiling they were seeing of Latinos there was similar to the racial profiling they were seeing here in New Orleans. So they really built those bridges. So I want to also emphasize not just those two organizations, but other organizations I mentioned in the piece,
like Breakout.
Breakout, right, the organization of LGBT youth of color who are dealing with the prison industrial complex. They also work closely with the Congresso, work closely with STAN. So you really have, in general, close relationships between these different organizing communities, and they come together through forums like an organization called the Organizers Roundtable. That's a coalition where organizers from these different communities get together once a month. Another coalition called Justice and Beyond brings together these organizers, so people hear about the different struggles they're working on and find ways that they can collaborate.
And you mentioned it very quickly, so we only have a few minutes left, is VALIA, the Vietnamese American Young Leaders Association. That's been growing and Rethink, the high school students. When you put all these together, and you have this one paragraph in here, this one sentence about the context of history of whites using violence to retain control of city government, the violence of post-Katrina seemed uncannily familiar. Then again, so has a response. So I'm curious, so given that history and given where we are now in New Orleans, what do you see as building here? And also given that 100,000 people still are displaced and not living in New Orleans again.
It's complicated. It's a complicated situation. You know, I think, as I mentioned, these culture workers have made a difference. In fact, disproportionately, the people who are members of Social Aid and Pleasure Clubs and brass bands and Mardi Gras Indian crews were able to come back after Katrina because of this cultural organizing that happened. And so I think people around the country can really learn both from the neoliberal attack on these institutions like education, healthcare, and also on the resistance and how people have fought back. And I think people have fought and continue to fight for justice. It's a difficult city to live in. If you're poor, rents are going up remarkably. Home prices are going up rapidly. But there is a real struggle, and they've made real differences, and they've been able to keep many people back, keep many of the cultural institutions alive. And I think that struggle is ongoing and is, in fact, continuing to rise up.
Well, this is I love the piece you wrote, and I would love to continue talking with you as time goes on to see how these movements grow in New Orleans and keep this alive, this conversation. I just think you did a great work. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And I'll just mention people, in addition to that piece, there's also a video piece that I directed as well that's also on the Nation Magazine website, or people can also see it at gritTV.org.
And we're going to put that on our website as well. So Jordan Flaherty is a New Orleans-based journalist and filmmaker, author of the book Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to Jenna 6. And his new short film, New Orleans Recovery or Removal, can be seen at grittv.org and is also will be on our website and on the Nation Magazine website as well. Jordan, thanks so much for your contribution to everything and for taking time for the Mark Steiner Show today on this Katrina 10th anniversary special.
Thank you, Mark.
We're about to take a very brief break, but don't go away. There's more in our Katrina 10th anniversary special. Stay with us.
You better second life. When I die.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, right here on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And tomorrow is the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, making landfall in New Orleans. And today we're spending the whole program bringing you a two-hour broadcast on that storm, its aftermath, and the current state of New Orleans. We're about to now talk with Christina K. Robinson, as a writer, artist, New Orleans native, who wrote a piece in The Nation called The 10 Years Since, A Meditation on New Orleans, and Karen Gadbois, who is a founder and reporter at The Lens, a New Orleans first investigative news nonprofit she helped found. And she wrote a piece also in The Nation, Empty Reasons. So it's good to have you both with us. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
So let me begin. First thing, I read your piece first, Christina, then I read Karen's piece. And Christina, for both of your pieces, but especially yours, one of the things that I felt in reading it, this was kind of it was analytical, but it was this deeply felt essay about what it meant to be black in New Orleans and displaced. And there was cultural resistance. I mean, it was kind of grabbing America by its lapels and saying, read this, listen to what I have to say. Is that fair?
Yes, sure. Fair, very fair. Katrina was a disaster that happened to everyone present in New Orleans and affected the black residents of New Orleans in a particular way. And I really wanted to communicate that. That a lot of how you might have experienced Katrina definitely depended on your race.
So, I mean, this really is it. I mean, I think that, Karen, what you point out in Empty Promises, I mean, just that's literally what it was. And I think people don't really get that in America who might be listening to this, that a lot of promises were made about tearing down projects and rebuilding. A lot of promises were made about tearing schools down and rebuilding, and they didn't happen.
That's right. I began to track the process of demolition early on after the storm, mostly from just a curiosity about what the city would look like visually, so unsure of what it would look like in terms of people returning and population shifts. And I just was curious. Near my house, an entire block had been burnt down during the storm. So this is a physical world that we lived in was so rapidly changed. I was curious. And in looking at the schools, there was one school in particular, the neighborhood in the upper Ninth Ward, much less visited part of the city, much less often written about part of the city. There had been a school called the Johnson Locket, which had been there serving that community and an anchor in the community. And they were told that it would be rebuilt in a phase two, which never happened. It served as an anchor, and then the anchor was gone.
And in a lot of ways, Christina, the whole question to me is about, you can use the word anchor, whether it's the anchor of what the African world meant for New Orleans and means for New Orleans, and how that anchor is being shattered.
Sure. New Orleans is a place I touch on that had the presence of indigenous people and Africans pre the settlement of New Orleans as we come to know it and post, and the devastation to the culture with 100,000 less people of African descent being in the city, is devastating to a place of which that culture is the bedrock. And so, it's something that to grapple with every day. You notice the loss of that 100,000 people. At least I have every day since I've been back. Definitely.
I think that's something that I really want to wrestle with this with you all for a minute, just because I think it's hard for many people to grapple with, to really understand. I mean, where can I start this? The fact that, you know, a lot of people talk about New Orleans as really a Caribbean culture, a Caribbean culture, that it's an African culture, Afro-Indio mm-hmm. culture, and mm-hmm. and that, but there's a depth to it you don't find in other parts of this country.
Sure.
And could you both talk to what that depth meant, and also what you think, and to what's happened to the city now in your own eyes?
Yes, it is very much a Caribbean culture, very much African-based culture, very much Afro-Indio. I think the thing that made New Orleans distinct pre-Katrina was this culture of resistance and... not that there isn't a culture of resistance in many places, in many black communities in the United States, but the particularities of this culture being so influenced by Latin cultures and kind of an unassimilated, un-Americanized, if you want to call it, way of life, worldview, traditions, all of these things, and kind of the displacement of 100,000 people and then the influx of a new set of people, and with simultaneously having these people be primarily our children's educators now, and the way that the restructuring of the school system all helped to displace and further disintegrate this culture that has persisted for so long. People are definitely doing all that they can to preserve it, but definitely under intense pressure with the complete social and political fabric being redrawn. Because not only did we have this culture, we also had a political structure and political culture as black people in New Orleans, which was very unique. And that has been a really devastating loss, and it has reverberations outside of politics.
And I want to come back to these reverberations in just a second. And Karen Gadbois, the piece Empty Promises made me think that the role that plays in it, because what I've read, and you can explain this to our listeners even better, is the numbers of black teachers, not just schools, being totally transformed and changed, but the number of black teachers and workers who have lost their jobs in this.
Yes.
Well, one of the things that attracted me to the loss of school story was that Ruby Bridges, who was known as one of the first, although she wasn't the first, she was one of the first to integrate the schools here in New Orleans in 1960, I believe. She would have gone to and did go to Lockett School, the school that was demolished, in kindergarten as she tested into the Franz School. The Franz School was saved and is commemorated as the school which was integrated. But the school which would have educated Ruby Bridges and all the Ruby Bridgeses before her was torn down and not sort of commemorated and memorialized in the same way. And I thought that it was emblematic of this sort of discarding of history, which is so sort of wrongheaded in my mind in terms of how we honor the past. So there's this sort of ingrained sense. I talked to some of the neighbors recently who said that the relics in the schools, or the things that the cabinet you see when you walk into a school with the awards and et cetera, they can't find any of those material pieces of the school's history. So to me, it's those institutions are we're all raised up to believe that we should honor the institutions that we are a part of. And in New Orleans, there was a systematic effort to dishonor those institutions. And I think for children, especially, my daughter was a freshman in high school at the time, it's very confusing to say we should have pride in place and then turn around and say we should have shame of our place. You want to speak to that?
Yeah, go ahead, Christina, because I mean the place piece is really important.
Sure. The school system dismantling had, you know, devastating consequences for students and teachers. My mother, the public school teacher, and I was with her when she got this notice 3 months after Katrina that she had lost her job and had been fired. She was lucky enough to be rehired when she came back, but many people she taught with for years were never rehired into the school system and have had to take other jobs, none of which, you know, are comparable to the pay or lifestyle that they were living before. And so these 7,500 teachers that were laid off, made up of mostly black women from New Orleans, found it a lot of the bedrock of the black middle class in New Orleans, which has, you know, taken great losses as a result of this. One of the most likely jobs that you did if you were a black female and made a middle class salary would be a public school teacher. And now, in the times that I've participated as maybe a tutor or a guest artist or something of the sort in some of these charter schools, I might have been the only black female in the building. There was one more. You know, and the things that I witnessed there, the things that I witnessed children have to deal with, devastated me. And I was an adult, so I couldn't imagine how I would feel if I was a child. And this was my only educational experience. You know, it's quite traumatizing to see and experience.
I think people,
and that trauma continues. I mean, I don't think that it was a traumatizing event. It continues to be a traumatizing event. Throughout the way we pass this information on to our children, and it sort of is a resonating event.
Yes, but Karen, I mean, the two of you have both also decided this is your home. You're making a stand here. So I'm curious, both your feelings and ideas as we close this out, about where the stand takes you next. I mean, what you see the future of New Orleans as being now. Go ahead, Karen. We'll start with Karen. We'll end up with Kay. Go ahead.
I'm not a native New Orleanian. I moved here in 2001 from Mexico. I had lived in Mexico for about 15 years. So I was already out of my own culture, which is Boston, where I grew up. And I chose New Orleans because it reminded me very much of my time in Mexico. My daughter was born in Mexico. So this is where we came when she was in middle school. And my it's sort of becoming not so much a decision to stay here as the question of an ability to stay here. We've had a surge in cost of living that makes it much more difficult to make those choices. If you're fortunate enough to be in a situation in which the rising cost of property taxes and insurance isn't affecting you, then maybe you can make a cleaner decision. I live with someone who's seventh ward native and has been here his many generations. I asked him the other night if he could imagine us leaving, and he said he would always have to have a spot here, a piece of ground. And I think that is one universal theme I hear from folks who have had their properties torn down or chose to tear their properties down. They can't let go of that piece of land, that piece of swamp. The muck is too thick.
Muck is too thick. And Christina K. Robinson, I mean, this is your home. This is who you are. This is what you feel and breathe. So where do you see it?
Every day is really, I don't want to be dramatic, but I don't think it's dramatic to call it a battle to stay. It is a battle to stay with the rising cost of living and wages not rising along with it. And also to add to that is the experience of erasure that Native Black New Orleanians are feeling here, and the difficulty that you have in obtaining employment in certain arenas just based off the fact that you are a Native-born Black New Orleanian. You know, it's difficult. And so you feel this push, you know, this literal pushing of yourself out, attempts to push you out,
I feel committed to stay as long as I have the ability to stay, and every day is a battle to make that happen because it is where I'm from. My family's from four generations, and I don't want to cede it to those who don't deserve it. And you know, it doesn't mean that I will be successful, but I will definitely try.
Well, this has been a treasure and an honor to talk to the both of you, and I appreciate Christina K. Robinson, the work you've just been doing, and the article you put into The Nation, which I thought was really a phenomenally strong piece that you can just feel it through every word.
Thank you.
I really mean that. And as a writer, artist, and New Orleans native, Karen Gadbois, who's founder and reporter for The Lens, in New Orleans' first investigative news nonprofit, as well, for your piece. Thank you both so much for taking your time today on the Mark Steiner Show for our Katrina 10th anniversary special.
Thank you so much.
The first thing I thought was, I ain't never coming back. Oh, it's going to be a long time before this city get back. The whole time I was watching on TV, it kind of felt like a movie. Yeah. But it's like when you actually get back and see all that, it kind of hits you.
That used to be my room. My parents' room. The bed was still made. Ain't that a... This is our living room. This was our little dining room. Kitchen. F***ed up. My sister room, guest room, f***ed up.
It was horrible. Mm-hmm. No electricity, no lights. Funky smell. Mm-hmm. You could still see the water line. House full of mud. Mud was about 3 inches thick in your house. You couldn't really walk in your house. It was still wet. Mm-hmm. The refrigerator was full of millions of gnats, little bugs. Yeah. You open it, it's like, you're not inside a refrigerator white. You open it, it's black, but it's not black from dirt. That's how many bugs they had now.
That was a clip from the new film, Kellen and Katrina, from colorlines.com. The film was produced by Tara Conley, social media manager at Race Forward. The film follows Kellen, a musician and New Orleans resident. And Tara and Kellen, welcome. Good to have you here on the Mark Steiner Show on our Katrina special.
Thank you for having us.
No, it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
So this was a very powerful and telling short documentary, and how you put all that stuff in 12 minutes, that was 10 years worth, I have no idea, but you did it. But tell us, first of all, just very quickly, the genesis of this project, how you got into this.
So, yeah, when Hurricane Katrina hit, I was actually living in Houston, Texas at the time, and I had volunteered with the Red Cross. And so when I was volunteering, I took my camera with me, and I wanted to start interviewing folks just to have some sort of documentation of what was going on. Then a year later, I met Kellen through a mutual friend, a music producer, and was like, well, can we just sit down and can you tell me your story? And that's kind of where it started. And then over the past several years, we've just stayed in contact, and I've gone to New Orleans a couple times, and we've filmed. It's a story about his journey, and he could talk more about that, but it's also kind of a story about kind of our friendship over the years, and just having the privilege really to be able to tell Kellen's story with him over these 10 years or so.
So, Kellen, yeah, talk a bit about that. I mean, so it is very poignant, the whole piece, and when you went back and saw the apartment, the house you had with your parents. But tell a bit about what happened to you on that day, 10 years ago.
The day when the storm came?
Yeah.
Actually, most of us, we're so used to getting hurricanes down in New Orleans, we didn't take it as serious. Everything was pretty much a surprise. The city did a mandatory evacuation, but you know, you still had a handful of people, well, actually more than a handful, a lot of people who was like, well, we're just going to ride it out just like every other storm. And actually, me, personally, I waited till the last, I think, the night before it came, I finally made up my mind to leave. And, you know, we thought it was typical. We're just going to leave And a few days, everything was going to be over. We would come back home. And it just, the more and more we watched the news, the more and more it got, just got worse. And we just kind of realized we was probably never going to come back. Or if we did come back, it was going to be a long time and it wasn't going to be the same. For me personally, I made a good decision on leaving that day, because I was really about to stay. So I don't have the experience of actually going through it. I just pretty much have the experience of the aftermath of it, you know, coming back, rebuilding, and being displaced for 3 years and pretty much not seeing everybody.
And Tara, I'm curious what the effect this had on you. I mean, when you opened this film and walk with Kellum back into the place that he had lived, I mean, that was a very powerful piece, and was very moving. And Kellum's story could be told 100,000-fold more.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a powerful question. I always, when I talk about the events of Hurricane Katrina, and especially thinking about my relationship to Kellum and his story, Katrina has made an impact on my life ever since it happened. I mean, it's shaped how I've told stories over the years. It shaped my perspective of, you know, systemic issues and racial inequalities and social inequities. And, I mean, it's also developed me as a thinker and as a scholar, and it's sort of colored how I see the world, even to this day. And, you know, being able to sort of tell this story, particularly, and it's almost like full circle, being able to tell this story through color lines and race forward, it's important work. It's storytelling as a way to sort of capture all of these sort of isms and big issues that we talk about and we think about all the time. And it's difficult for me to separate, you know, the story and my involvement in it from a sort of an indirect way. And the way that the world is right now, you know, we have a lot of problems in this country. And I think the events of Hurricane Katrina really captured that. And there isn't really a moment when I'm not thinking about how, you know, the way that we treat our citizens after, whether it's natural disaster, whether it's man-made disaster, whether it's shootings on the block, you know, whether it's any kind of major issue that we have in this country. So, yeah, it certainly colored my view of the world, of this country, and the way we handle taking care of each other.
And another piece that really struck me in this, and I think it's really important to touch on, I mean, because Kellum, you talk about the, you know, your passions and the for music, the work you do, the other work you do to make a living, building your family, that beautiful shot of you and your baby towards the end of the piece, holding a baby. But what really, so I mean, I could see your solidity as a man and as a father, as a human being through all this and what you went through. But what really struck me was the piece when you all talked together about, when you talked about, I never thought about death the way I think about death since, and maybe it is Katrina, and talk about all the people who suffer in that one piece that Tara put up about from post-traumatic stress because of Katrina. Would you mind talking a bit about that? Because, I mean, that to me was something that we do not hear enough about.
About the stress.
Yeah, the stress you feel. I mean, you know, this when you walked, hit that bowling alley, said, this is what relieves my stress when you hit that, when you hit all the pins, when you made that strike, but when you got that strike. So, but talk a bit about that stress.
The stress, well, I'll start off by saying this, in the beginning, kind of closer, maybe about a year or two after Katrina, you know, we always heard about, you know, a lot of people are seeking counseling because of depression, from the storm, from losing everything. And, me personally, I kind of overlooked it for a while. I never knew. I was like, well, I'm not stressed, you know, and, I'm not really, I mean, I'm stressed, but I'm not depressed. I mean, I didn't really understand the difference until maybe 2-3 years ago. And a lot of us were in denial about being stressed out. We didn't We didn't know we were stressed out. We just thought we went through something, and now we're back. But years later, you know, from my personal experience, from seeking counseling, you know, I come to find out that I am or was and still is a little bit in a state of depression. And my two cents, I think, and I'm pretty sure it has a lot to do with the displacement from Hurricane Katrina. It's kind of like a delayed effect with me. It wasn't an instant stress. And I think that had a lot to do with my age at the time. I was kind of young-minded, just looking at it as, oh, I'm in a new city, new opportunity, let's just start over. But now as I'm getting older, looking back and really realize what's going on, and I'm actually living in a difference. The aftermath, you know, actually witnessing the change now since I've been back for 4 or 5 years, it's stressful not seeing, you know, the people you used to seeing every day. Like New Orleans, we're a small community, so we used to just, if you get bored, we used to just go walk down the street and go, you know, hang on a porch or go to somebody's house, play cards and hang out. We can't do that no more because everybody's, you know, in Atlanta and Houston, Seattle, Arkansas, like we all spread out everywhere. It's not the same like it used to be. And I think that plays a big role on our stresses, just like, because we used to use those things as stress relievers. You know, we used to get together and talk and, like I said, play cards and just hang out. And we don't have that opportunity as a stress reliever no more because we don't see each other no more. I mean, I may see a friend or a family once every 2-3 weeks, if that, you know, just because we don't have that community like we used to have. Right. And bowling, like I was saying in the interview, that's my, you know, that always have been my stress reliever, but I never looked at it as a stress reliever until now, you know.
Right, and
I used to just look at it as bowling because I love bowling. But now, you know, my point of view on it now is like, I actually feel at peace when I'm here. I don't think about nothing else. Mm-hmm. But when I'm not bowling, you know, all my worries come back. And, you know, just, I guess that's the best way I can explain it.
And that's a powerful way to explain it, and I think you, I mean, you did it in the film. You did it even in real depth here right now, and I think people felt something they didn't understand before about New Orleans. And Tara, you know, when you made this piece and you talk about how the neighborhoods that were hit the worst, the people who never came back, were the poorest, were African Americans, mm-hmm. were the lowest unemployment, the highest unemployment. I mean, and watching what you've seen, also watching Kellen rebuild his life, I'm just curious what you walk away with all this from. What do you walk away with?
Well, a few things, but I'll just say this. One of the primary things that I come away with is sort of this idea of, you know, a community that has already been shattered and broken even before Katrina, but it's we can see more now, even that shattering and that breaking after Katrina. So you have communities, you know, Black communities that have been, as Kellen just wonderfully articulated, have been kind of displaced and separated because of the storm. People are all over the place now. Some have come back, but and just as Kellen said in the film, he's like, it's home, but it's not really like home. So you have communities that are, I mean, and there's communities like the French Quarter is taken care of, right?
Right.
You know, there's private investment there, there's government funding there, there's people want that area to be okay. But then you have the surrounding communities that are still suffering, there's still blighted communities and homes around there. So when you ask this question, like, you know, what does it mean to take care of your community? What does it mean for a city to rebuild, what does community development mean? You start to see that there are two versions, or maybe three versions of that. And the Black communities and the communities of color largely have been, you know, victims of that and subjugated along these several years. And that's what I mean when we talk about storytelling as a way to capture systemic racism, which I think that this story does in an interesting kind of way.
No, I think it does in more than interesting kind of way. I think it's a very powerful piece in that we're going to a Katrina survival story told over 10 years. We're going to post it on our website so everybody can see it at steinershow.org. And I think you both made a very profound short film. And even this small segment we've done with you all at this moment, I think you've said some very profound and important things for our listeners to wrestle with, and listeners all over the country listening to this to wrestle with who are not in New Orleans. So first, I want to thank Tara Conley for making this film and doing the work you do. I think that's really important. And Kellen, being able to stand up as a man and tell your survival story, I think has been important for the country to hear. And so I want to thank both of you for what you're doing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, right here on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're going to take a very brief break here. Don't go away. We're coming right back. You'll hear the rest of our special on the 10th anniversary of Katrina. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. I'm gonna set your flag on fire. Talking about henna, 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 henna. Aiko, aiko, ande. Shagamo fino, anane. Shagamo fino, ande. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, right here on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And tomorrow is the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, making landfall in New Orleans. And today we're spending the whole program bringing you a two-hour broadcast on that storm, its aftermath, and the current state of New Orleans. I'm speaking with Adam Carlin, freelance journalist and travel writer based in New Orleans, and has been doing this for many years. And Adam, welcome. Good to have you with us.
How's it going, Mark?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm good.
So a couple of things I was thinking about. Early in the program, we heard from Tracy Washington, who talked about the change in the population with 100,000 less people, and most of those folks leaving New Orleans being African Americans, and new people coming in, most of whom are not African Americans.
Right.
And that the one of the draws in New Orleans has always been the culture, and that this is having a deep effect on the culture of New Orleans. What are your thoughts as both a newcomer and somebody who does travel and is into these things?
Yeah, so I traveled to a lot of American cities, and I think this process of gentrification is definitely not limited to New Orleans. I mean, you can find this happening not just in major American cities, but even kind of mid-sized ones. A friend of mine who just moved to Cincinnati was saying he was shocked by how much gentrification is happening there. And like, you don't think of Cincinnati when you think gentrification. So I think this process of like millennials moving back into cities is not limited to New Orleans. But what is unique in New Orleans is the social conditions that preceded that gentrification. And obviously Katrina and the displacement of thousands of African Americans, you know, that's what came before. And I think it's something that everyone who moves here has to grapple with, especially if you move here because you love the city. And I think that is something that is true of a lot of New Orleans gentrifiers, is that they came here because they really love New Orleans. But in the process of moving there, you know, the dynamic of the city changes, and it's weird to move to a place when you're simultaneously changing that place.
So what does that mean concretely? I mean, have you seen that? You've been to New Orleans before that. So, I mean, what does it mean? What's different for you?
I think what's different is I hate using the word authentic, but there is a certain New Orleans that whatever zeitgeist was there before, whatever New Orleans was like, down to accents and the way people treat each other and the way you engage somebody at the bar or engage somebody on the street, it's different in places where you have a lot of transplants. At the same time, I definitely don't think that the transplants come here and become unchanged. Like, I mean, they also become a little more New Orleans-y in the process of coming here, or else they leave, right? In that way, you know, I guess one of the other things I've seen is certainly at the sort of street celebrations that are traditionally been in African American New Orleans, like the Second Lines and stuff like that.
Yeah.
you see a lot more non-black faces, and I think that that's directly a result of new people coming to New Orleans and being willing to attend those things in a way that, you know, maybe non-African-American New Orleanians would have been more leery about that in previous years. The presence of those non-African-American faces at the second lines, I mean, I think it's a contentious subject because I think in some way people like sharing their culture, but in other ways, you know, are 100 snapping iPhones, like, does that take away from that culture?
And what do you think?
Nothing is frozen in amber, right? Like, even New Orleans, as much as people talk about New Orleans being the most Caribbean city in the USA, like, is still in the USA. And at the end of the day, some of these things are going to happen in New Orleans, like people taking pictures of second lines and tweeting them and everything else. It's a matter of time when it was going to happen. I guess it was a question of when and not if. Since it is going to happen, I think the process, then what you need to be, if you're on the ground here, as a resident or as a tourist, is you try and be respectful. You know, you don't get up in people's faces, and you don't treat their culture as something to just consume and then throw away. You treat it as an entity that deserves respect. The specifics of that are, you know, kind of case by case, but it's something I try and do as someone who lives here now.
So I'm curious, you know, and one of the conversations with other people have, when we're looking at this 10th anniversary of Katrina, is that part of the flavor of the city has changed because there are a lot of new people in there, mostly of whom are not African American, and many of the African Americans who live there for generations are now living in Houston and Alabama and Atlanta and other places.
Yeah.
So what does that mean about your dynamic and how that changed the city and what you think that might mean for the future and what your responsibility is there?
I feel like, responsibility-wise, look, I hate coming in here and saying, you know, on a macro level, I'm going to try and make the city a better place, because I think that's really pretentious and condescending. On a micro level, I try to make it a better place by being a good citizen, watching out for my neighborhood and watching out for my block, and being engaged, you know, because I think as much as there's been criticism directed at newcomers, the fact of the matter is this gentrification couldn't have happened without a lot of collusion from an existing political and real estate class that was pretty local at the end of the day. So if we want to preserve this culture, like, it's on us as people living here to try and engage that class.
So, and of course, with that class being the old power structure, and most of that power structure being white, not just always making it that way, but that's reality as well.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious how you would envision being part of this new wave of trying to reinvigorate a city and what that might mean to you. I mean, I know the city well too, and I love it, and I've not spent much time there since Katrina, so I don't have a feel for what it looks like.
Right.
But you do.
Yeah. So when you say people trying to reinvigorate it, I guess, are you talking of, I've met those people, and I think that the best efforts at that tend to be, as you'd guess, you know, it's when there's a lot of collaboration with people who already live here. I mean, I think the worst way to reinvigorate New Orleans is to come to New Orleans and say, this is what's best for you, without doing some on-the-ground, you know, research and dialogue with the people who actually live here, like the actual stakeholders in the city.
Right. No, exactly. And how have you seen that take place?
Well, so for example, a friend of mine is, you know, who is also a transplant, is now directing a local nonprofit here that deals with bicycle transportation issues. I would say that he is very engaged with city council and meets with them a lot. At the same time, I think he realizes that just because you're meeting with someone in the city council doesn't mean that that city council person, that their ideas are what their, you know, what their constituents want. And so he also spends a lot of time canvassing in the neighborhoods, trying to figure out what local people want in terms of transportation options. I mean, that's one example, but I mean, I could think of others that, you know, where people are trying to engage the town, at kind of a neighborhood individual level, but also at a, you know, power structure level.
Now, and just for you, I mean, we've talked in the past. I mean, we talked. You moved into Treme, correct?
Well, I moved into the Treme initially, but now I live in the Bywater, which is ground zero for a lot of transplant New Orleans.
So that's interesting. So, what about that neighborhood? Talk about that neighborhood.
The Bywater is a neighborhood in the Upper Ninth Ward, and in fact, even saying Bywater is a kind of contentious thing because a lot of locals would just call it Ninth Ward Bywater. Uh-huh. I mean, it was a name, and it's appeared on postal service stuff going back to the late 1800s, I think. But in terms of, like, everyday usage, I feel like, you know, there are people who would say that's a bit of a real estate term. But nonetheless, I mean, the official neighborhood association name is the Bywater Neighborhood Association, so we'll go with Bywater. Anyway, I mean, it's a neighborhood that's kind of... it's the sort of place that you would expect to gentrify. It's close enough to the center of the city, especially the French Quarter. That's literally a 10-minute bike ride away, but had the cheap enough rents that it attracted artists. And to be fair, you know, if you want to talk about gentrification, the Bywater is an aesthetic, a static place. It actually gentrified with a lot of artists and, you know, people like that in the 80s and 90s. So the post-Katrina gentrification, while it's definitely happened and very much changed the nature of this neighborhood and raised the cost of living, it's not the first wave of gentrification to hit this neighborhood by a long shot.
So I'm, you know, when you look at the at what you've seen there, I mean, and the school system, I'm curious, you have a kid and too young for school yet?
Yeah, right.
Get there. And so what about education in New Orleans and the battles around education that you've seen as a parent of a baby who may be going to school there?
Yeah, it's something I'm nervous about, something that I'm trying to, that I research about. I don't think every parent in New Orleans is dealing with that issue. I think what's frustrating also is that the way education was dealt with in Orleans Parish had a lot to do with how the state of Louisiana dealt with that education. And so you're trying to deal with it as both a citizen of Orleans Parish and as a citizen of Louisiana. And Louisiana's political direction often goes in a different direction from the direction that New Orleans wants. But long story short, I mean, you know, schools are a big issue for me. And at this stage, I'm kind of recusing myself from the bigger political questions around it, and I'm more concerned about finding the right school for my kid.
Gotcha. No, that's what a parent does, right?
Yeah.
And one of the just again, you're going back and forth. I'm just curious what you see as the future of New Orleans. I mean, you're there. You're settling in.
Yeah.
You're editing an online journal that has to do with the city itself. So, what do you see the future?
I think New Orleans, it's changed, and that change is going to be there. I think that it will absorb the changes of post-Katrina and the people who have come post-Katrina, and it will change them as well. I think it will become a more American city in some ways, but I think that...
homogenized, you mean?
How's that?
Homogenized?
Maybe a little bit more homogenized. But, you know, Mark, I got to say, like, with people are critical of that, but if you go to, say, the new Walmart or the new, there's a new kind of strip mall development off Carrollton Avenue, and as much as, like, we use homogenization as a bad word, a lot of the people shopping in that Walmart and those strip malls are local people, local African Americans, you know? So I can't totally say that... I feel uneasy saying that it's necessarily a bad thing if so many local citizens are shopping at those places. But yes, I think that it will get a little more of America will come in. But at the same time, I think that that's something that's happening on a global scale. Like that's something I see happening literally everywhere I go because that sometimes has to do with things that are outside the purview of New Orleans. I mean, that has to do with a global culture that's fueled by internet and social media. You know, I've got a good friend here whose kid gets tutored by a pretty famous New Orleans musician. And I asked him, you know, does your kid like New Orleans music? And he's like, not really, but I'm hoping he'll learn to appreciate it. Because this guy, you know, he also said that growing up in mid-city New Orleans, he wasn't that into local New Orleans music. He learned to appreciate it, you know, later on when he got into college. So I guess, you know, what is here, if it has that pull, it will hopefully always have that pull. But the trick is making sure you preserve what's here.
But Adam, I really look forward to talking more about this and seeing where else you can take us in the coming years as we look at New Orleans. And I appreciate you willing to take the time to talk to our listeners today here on this 10th anniversary of the Katrina hurricane.
No problem. Thanks, Mark.
My pleasure. Adam Carlin is a freelance journalist, travel writer. Adam, take care. Thanks so much.
I could even feel
the great big and gold. Politicians stand in the city they care for God.
We're about to have a conversation now with writer, photographer, New Orleans native, Ellis Marsalis III. Ellis, welcome back to Steiner Show. It's been a long time. I'm glad you could make it here for this Katrina special.
Thank you very much.
So I know you are, you know, come from a family that's been associated with New Orleans for a long time. And I also know you're a very thoughtful man. And you look at this 10th anniversary, and you've been on our show when Katrina happened. You were on our show for the 5th anniversary and other times talking about Katrina. So I'm just, how do you reflect on this 10th anniversary and what it means for the place that you come from and where we might be going? Let's say, what are you contemplating on this 10th anniversary?
Basically, 10 years after the flood, I've been curious to see over the time, over this past 10 years, what would actually come back and what wouldn't come back, and how the city would look, which is like a lot of people. You know, and I know that for a lot of people, as I knew in the beginning, you know, it was one of the things my dad said, was that, well, you know, people who will be able to afford to come back will, and the people who won't. Which is a very simple way of saying that to a certain degree at the beginning, we knew it was going to be essentially survival of the fittest, which is really not unlike a lot of places, not unlike a lot of events. You know, living in this area and doing a lot of work in New York and New Jersey, I know people who lost a lot during Hurricane Sandy, and I know people who were able to rebuild and people who had to move. Because it really became the survival of the fittest. Because the insurance companies were never going to do what they purportedly promised to do, and they were going to wait you out, and which is what a lot happened to a lot of people. People at that point, you know, really were going to depend upon an infrastructure and a government that really was no longer going to support them. That being said, I think when you look at New Orleans now, it does serve as a little bit of a Rorschach test for people. And that people get to see whatever they want to see. You know, there are the hard numbers of who's returned and who didn't return and what communities have been revitalized and which communities haven't, and which communities are rebuilding, what constitutes gentrification, which, you know, from an unpopular standpoint, I'm not necessarily someone who's against gentrification. It's not a matter of that it happens. It's a matter of how does it happen. It's hard for me to say one way or the other. From the standpoint of whether everything is good or everything is bad, in the sense that everything is exactly what it is. It is some of the actions are remarkably predictable. Some of the reactions of the people are predictable. It's a work in progress. You know, there's still people who, you know, there's still going to be people who come back. There'll still be people who trickle back. You know, I know the city has made it very difficult for working class and poor people to return, because I think, you know, one of the problems that we have in the country as a whole is certainly a problem that many of the citizens of New Orleans have, but certainly not all. Many of the political establishment have, but not all, is to create a sort of synonymous relationship between poverty and crime as though it is the same thing. And it isn't the same thing.
in the very beginning, you know, a lot of people like said, we need to keep the poor people out. You know, we need to shut down these projects and whatnot. The real problem you face there is that criminals are going to come back regardless. They're not deterred by IDs or addresses or running water or good schools. They're not deterred by any of that. If they want to return, they'll return. Poor people, however, are deterred by that because they're trying to construct some semblance of a life like they had or like they envisioned. And though not having those things matter, it would in fact serve as a means to either keep them where they are, whether it's Atlanta or Houston or Baton Rouge or Slidell. And I think, you know, I don't think that that's necessarily a good idea.
But when you look at the fact that 100,000 people, almost all of them African Americans, almost all of them, not all, but all, many of them being working class and poor people and middle class people, may be gone from New Orleans forever, and some people think that that's kind of not by accident in terms of policy. Does that ring true to you?
Well, I don't. You know what? Once again, I wouldn't suggest that that's true. I know that that's certainly the desire of some people, absolutely. But it is the municipal government really cannot. It can really only prevent people from returning. The only people that can truly prevent from returning are those people who need help returning. I mean, I know lots of people who didn't necessarily need help. If you don't need help, you just go back. You go back. You put a stake in the ground, and you say, this is what I'm going to do. Here's where I am. Well, I know a lot of people that return. I mean, I got family members that return.
But most of those are poor folks who have not returned.
But most of the poor folks, I don't know that, once again, New Orleans has a lot of poor folks in it. And, you know, one of the things I think that we need to deal with is once what I said earlier with about the granularity of language, in the sense that when you dig down into what actually constitutes poor folks, I don't know that you can say, well, there's going to be X number of less people in the city, and this is a direct result, or even a mild indirect result from the policy set in place by the government. Because at the time, the policy was being set by Nagin. And Nagin's policy was nothing. Nagin really didn't do anything. Nagin, it was mostly paralysis. Specifically, there were a lot of people who wanted to do all kinds of things to prevent people from going back. Most of their policies didn't really come into place. There was certainly something that the federal government did that prevented people from returning.
Well, Ellis Marcellus, it's always a pleasure to have you on this program, and I deeply appreciate your thoughtfulness and what you add to this conversation on Katrina's 10th anniversary here on this special on the Mark Steiner okay. Show, and we look forward to talking to you again very soon for longer conversations.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a bunch.
Do you know what it means to miss New Orleans and miss it each night and day?
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern and Dan History research producer is Sienna Greaves. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.
The Mardi Gras, the memories of Creole tunes that fill the air. I dream of oleanders in June, and soon I'm wishing that I was there. Do you know what it means to miss New Orleans when that's where you left your heart? And there's something more. I miss the one I care for more than I miss New Orleans.
Bye.